But when we come with the conservationist term, because even the word conservation, it's not really the real deal. And conservation is actually a white person's idea. It's not even a black person's or an African person's idea, because us as conservationists, us as Africans, if we think about conservationists, we have been conservationists since the beginning of time. Our ancestors protected these places. They knew the trees, they knew the wildlife, they knew everything. So now when a white person came, it became they're the ones who knew about conservation. Yet, as Africans, we lived with wildlife.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Magnetica podcast. We are so glad that you chose to tune in, and we are so humbled and honored to have you as part of our audience. Today, we have another guest because, you know us, we love to learn from other people and hear the different perspectives. And our guest is a conservationist. Yes, I did not butcher that word. Yay. So her name is Vicky Wangui, and she will let us know what she does. She will introduce herself formally. The reason why she's here is because Earth Day was commemorated on April 22nd. And, you know, we want to know, as young people, why should we care? Why should we be thinking about Earth Day? Why is it so relevant today? Is it even relevant in the first place? Victoria and I met at Ondiri Wetlands. She will let us know what that is from a conservationist point of view. But if you're like me, being a tourist, being curious, when you go there, it's in Kikuyu, it's not very far. You'll get to step on this grass, which is bouncing because it's right on top of water. And it can actually handle your weight and many others. And you just step on it and you're bouncing. And the good thing about Ondiri, it has a really great story. It now has other conservationists like Victoria who are protecting it. So before Friends of Ondiri, people around, you know, just like many other wetlands, like rivers and lakes around us, polluted the environment, cut the grass way too much, and eventually life left the wetland. You know, it's amazing how nature works. So the birds left, the animals left, everything left. And right now they're bringing back life to the place, and Victoria will let us know how. Without further ado, Victoria, please introduce yourself.
Thank you so much, Purity, for this invitation to your podcast. So I'll begin first by saying, starting by where we met in Kikuyu at Ondiri Wetlands. So Ondiri Wetlands is actually Kenya's only quacking bog. What I mean by a quacking bog, it's a wetland that has accumulated peat. And peat means it's a deposit of dead plants, materials, which move when one walks on the surface. That's why it's a quacking bog. So the dead accumulated peat made it look like there's a grass cover above it. And according to if you talk to old people around Kikuyu or who've lived in Kikuyu from when they were kids, they will tell you the place was like a water. So Ondiri Wetland is actually coming from the word old lake. And then the Kikuyus butchered it to become Ondiri, like old lake and then Ondiri. So basically a wetland is a place is a place where the land is covered by water. So the places are physically seen as swamps or ponds or marshes, or they occur on the edges of the lake, or like estuaries when a river meets the ocean. So for Ondiri Wetland, for example, long ago it became a quacking, it was just clear water, like shining water. It used to glow. If you go to the place and imagine there's no grass above it, which you've seen, it's like a pit, a deposit that's of dead plant that has grown over time, you will actually become curious about how it was a long time ago and how, I'd like to say, evolution has taken place over time. So how do I know all this? I'm a conservationist by profession. not by profession, really. I'm a wildlife ecologist by profession and a conservationist because of passion. So growing up, I was interested in wildlife conservation, or let's just say it's something that I've always liked to do, from watching wildlife documentaries, visiting national parks and reserves in Kenya, and also reading books and magazines about wildlife from when I was a really, really young child. So over time, that grew into something huge. And in my undergraduate studies, I decided to do wildlife management and conservation, hence why I'm a conservationist by profession. So basically, I'm also a writer. I started a wildlife blog called Nikasilika, which basically speaks about wildlife and the environment and everything just in between. Sometimes we rant, sometimes we talk about nice initiatives like the Friends of Wundiri Wetland, who have worked so hard to protect this wetland from human encroachment and farming practices that have endangered the wetland over time. So for example, for Wundiri Wetland, it's really important because wetlands act as water purification systems, like they help the water stay clean. For example, Wundiri Wetland is one of the sources of Nairobi River. Like if you imagine Nairobi River starts and flows all the way to the coast. So for Wundiri Wetland, from where the water is, it's able to purify the water and extract nutrients and other pollutants from the water, making it safe for drinking. And it's less harmful for everyone, including plants, animals, and us human beings. Also, wetlands are very good at flood protection. If you realize, like in Nairobi, for example, when there's a heavy rain, it's always flooding in a whole city. And if you come to think about it, Nairobi was actually a swamp in the beginning. So when it floods, there's nowhere the water is going because there's no wetland. All the places have been built up. There's nowhere water can actually be stored. That's why a lot of flooding happens in Nairobi City, for example. So wetlands act as a sponge. Like when it rains, it's able to hold water. If right now, with the rains that happened during the Easter holiday, and you go to Wundiri, it's very, very wet. Like you need gumboots. Even Purity will tell you when she came to Wundiri, she wore gumboots because it was really wet. When you step on it, even when you step on the grass, the water levels, you start seeing water coming out from the grass. So what it does, it just stores water. It's like a water storage system. It's like a tank. And when the water is needed, it just flows continuously throughout the year. So that's why protecting wetlands is important. If you protect wetlands, you'll never lack water because the water has been stored and it will flow continuously over a long period of time. So yeah, and it's also a biodiversity hotspot. Like you'll find birds, reptiles, amphibians, sometimes fish, and even mammals. And this ensures that, for example, tourism thrives on wildlife. And especially in Africa, especially in Kenya, considering Kenya, we have all of the big five and we have so many national parks and reserves. So it provides like an income source where people can come visit like Purity did and learn more about wildlife and why we need to protect it. So yeah, I'll begin with that and then we can move on.
This is amazing. I've learned so much already. I already have questions. So you've told us who you are, what you do, and why you do it. This is very interesting. So when we met, we talked a little bit about our interest in podcasting. Of course, I didn't know you had a blog, but now I do. And you told me that you wanted to start a podcast and you wanted to rant, you know? And so being a conservationist, I'm very curious, what do you want to rant about and why?
There's so many things to rant about in this conservation space that many people don't know about, or just me being in the conservation space and sometimes seeing things from on the ground, like when you say when you're on the ground, mm-hmm. you get to see things and wonder, this is total nonsense. Mm-hmm. So for example, it's very true. For example, recently, like not so far away, like 2020, when COVID started, the Ministry of Tourism and Wildlife decided they want to fence Nairobi National Park. Well, it's okay, fence it, but it will come at a really huge cost. Most people don't know that Nairobi National Park connects to the Amboseli National Park. And it also connects to the Masai Mara National Reserve. Like there was a time elephants were moving from Masai Mara and then they were moving all the way, coming all the way to Suswa, and then they were moving all the way, like they were coming, looking to go to Nairobi National Park. That means long ago, it was a whole connection. Wildlife could move from Amboseli to Masai Mara. If you think about that, that's huge. That what have we done? We've built on these corridors, on these wildlife corridors, and we've taken land that was not ours, that was wildlife. So when Nairobi National, when the ministry wants to fence Nairobi National Park, it raises a huge question. Do we want to fence off wildlife inside a park and make it a zoo? And then at the same time, there are people out there on social media who are saying it should be fenced. But if you think about Kenya in particular, someone wants to fence it so that they can grab land. Because if you make Nairobi National Park a zoo, that means in an ecological perspective, everything in that place will die. Because now lions cannot move, lions and their prey cannot move. So it leads to inbreeding, and in the end, just the wildlife dissipate and they die, and the ecosystem just shrinks and becomes nothing. And when it becomes nothing, people will just see this is land that we can steal and buy and build apartments. And that will destroy Nairobi in general and make Nairobi even more hot. It's hot right now. And because of the amount of buildings that are around surrounding it, it brings like a heat, like as the heat becomes located in one particular place. I think I've said so many things, but the heat becomes located in one particular place. But now with Nairobi National Park, if it's protected, then if we talk about global warming, it ensures that there's a balance. Like if you consider, if we decide we are building apartments on Nairobi National Park, we're just destroying ourselves and we don't realize it. And the reason for fencing was to reduce human wildlife conflict. But if you think about it, the neighboring communities are Maasais who live mostly on the southern part. The Maasais have been living for wildlife for the longest time possible. So even when they have issues of human wildlife conflict, of lions attacking them, lions attacking their livestock, it's something they've lived with and they've learned to adapt with. But when we come with the conservationist term, because even the word conservation, it's not really the real deal. And conservation is actually a white person's idea. It's not even a Black person's or an African person's idea. Because us as conservationists, us as Africans, if we think about conservationists, we have been conservationists since the beginning of time. Our ancestors protected these places. They knew the trees, they knew the wildlife, they knew everything. So now when a white person came, it became they're the ones who knew about conservation. Yet, as Africans, we lived with wildlife. So the reason I want to start a podcast is to just rant about all these things. There's so many things to rant about. Not even just government things, but even how we've lost our touch with nature. How, as an African, you're thinking about building apartments on Nairobi National Park. That means you've just lost a part. The only thing you're thinking about is greed. Greed leads us to nowhere. Greed is just, it destroys us. In the end, it will just destroy all of us. And for that, sometimes I think we are short-sighted and we don't see the dangers we pose to plant on our planet. We don't even recognize that our children's children will come on this earth and they will suffer. Even if they have money, you can't eat what, you can't eat oil, you can't eat buildings, you can't eat tarmacked roads, you can't eat anything that is just some thing that you can't even do anything with it. So that's why I want to start a podcast, which is going to start very soon. And we will rant and talk about these things and maybe highlight it. And one of my favorite books on conservation is called The Big Conservation Lie. I think many people should read it because it highlights the nonsense that is happening in the conservation space. And most conservationists don't like that book because they think it's telling a lie. But when people are saying a book is telling a lie, who's telling a lie? See, they're the ones who are telling a lie. It's called The Big Conservation Lie. So you're among the liars. Yeah, so that's why I want to start a podcast.
So you've talked very passionately, you know, about how we're not making very strategic decisions as far as how we interact with nature, and you've given a very good example. I actually didn't know that Nairobi National Park was connected to Amboseli and Masai Mara. That's very interesting because it puts things into perspective. So my question is, in the near future, and I would even say, let me just say near future, it's likely that we are not going to stop, right? We're not going to stop fencing things. We're not going to listen very keenly to what conservationists are telling us or people who actually interact with this knowledge are telling us. So what do we do? Like, what do you suggest that we do moving forward?
For me, this is how I think about it. As a conservationist or someone who's interested about wildlife, there are stages in my life, like I had, what is it called? Like the 5 stages of grief. There are stages I've had that, like denial, like thinking these people don't even care. Why am I even bothered about telling them how to protect it? I've gone through a whole 5 stages of grief. And if you talk to conservationists or especially climate activists, they will tell you they go through the same thing. Sometimes you're seated and you can't sleep because you're stressed. And then you wonder why you're stressed. You're stressed because people don't understand why you're protecting what you're protecting. So for me, I just woke up one day and decided, I'm not going to stress myself. I can't control this. I can't control what is happening. I can't control how human beings are thinking. That shouldn't be my problem. The thing is, I encourage people to be responsible human beings, to be honest, to just look at how they live their lives and take action in the smallest way. Like Professor Wangari Maathai once said, it's the little things you do that make a difference. May I don't expect you to become a conservationist or study wildlife ecologist and make a difference. In fact, you will barely make a difference. If I follow the path of being a wildlife ecologist, I'd be somewhere in the field studying an animal, or studying an insect, or studying a plant. But for me, I've just been interested in telling people how things work. And if they don't want to listen, that is okay. I have this mantra where if I write something and one person reads it and they make a difference, I have changed everything. I don't need 10,000 people to make a difference, just that one person. And if that one person makes a difference, it could be just one person who reads something and then decides, oh, I can become a policymaker. I can go to parliament. I can make things different. For example, for the Nairobi National Park fencing scenario, it was a management plan. People just woke up and decided, no, we are not agreeing with what you guys are saying, and we are not going to agree to what you guys are saying. That's collective. That's an action that someone has taken because they love to protect this area. And I always say not everyone needs to know about why they need to protect this place. If I wake up and a policy has changed, it was changed by just maybe a few people, and other people are just living their daily lives. It's okay. There are so many things to fight about this world, even if climate change affects every single part of our daily lives. As long as there are people protecting it, for me, it's okay, and it stops stressing me. And I realized everyone can take action, no matter how small. Even if you go and plant a tree, even if you decide, like, what I like these days is, especially when COVID happened, people realized they don't like being caged in a house. And that is how animals in zoos feel. That's how animals in the Nairobi National Park orphanage feel. They are cramped up. If you realize that, and then people started bringing in nature into their house, they started having house plants. In the long term, people don't realize it. But when you touch soil and you're here just taking care of soil and you're saying you are a plant mom, you don't realize that you're connecting with nature. And it goes a long way in you. The next time you say, oh, I want to go to the park, or oh, I want to go, or you stay at home for a long time, and then you start realizing there's so much rubbish around our neighborhood. Why is there so much rubbish? And then you call your community, your neighbors, and say, we cannot have rubbish being dumped here. That's also an impact. That's something you're doing. So for me, like when, and then you go hiking. There's so much you can learn when you go hiking. There's so much you can connect with nature. When you just go hiking or you go traveling to a wild area, like one of the most important things is to be with nature and to understand why you're fighting it. You just visit it and then you see a plant or you see plastic. Like every single day when I open social media, sometimes you see people are angry because of pollution, because of like the issue of the Nairobi National Park. So I always say things we can build. I don't have a problem with development. In fact, I like development. Thing is, it should be sustainable. It should think about the future and the future generation. And years from now, a road that was built can actually be brought down. It has happened in the US. A whole highway was demolished and it became a green space. Like it became a really green space. So even if you've built something, it's something that can actually be destroyed. If you can destroy nature, then CB can also destroy our buildings and put up a wildlife corridor or something. So for me, the way I see it, I stopped stressing myself. I went through the 5 stages of grief as a conservationist and realized there's always hope, and realized I don't have to force people to understand. It's not their problem. Some people here are struggling to wonder why Mafuta Imepanda, and then I'm telling them here about conservationists. Yet, I know why oil is rising, especially for cooking oil. Cooking oil, for example, is made from palm oil. Palm oil is the leading cause of deforestation in Indonesia, and people don't know that. So as things unfold, then we find solutions. There'll always be someone who will come up with a solution, no matter how small. So that's how I take my perspective on, will things ever change? Yes, they will. It will just take time and they may get worse. But at the end of the day, people will realize that a connection with nature is very important.
I like the balance between passion and letting go of control. I like it. I think it's a healthy balance.
Makes you alive. You won't die.
Exactly. And you won't die even of depression, you know?
Yeah.
So there's something that you mentioned when we last talked, which was about how we are not strategically, how we are planting trees, but it's not being strategically done. So in essence, what you're saying is it's great we are planting trees and we are participating in these campaigns, but a tree is not just a tree. Could you talk about that?
So when I talk about trees, this is how I think about it. Planting trees has become like a fandom, the same thing with cleanups. Planting trees is not just planting trees. You need to grow it. You need to nurture it. And in the first place, you need to know why, which kind of species of trees are you planting? Are you planting an indigenous tree? Are you planting an exotic tree? Are you planting a fruit tree? Why are you planting all these trees? For example, when we are doing tree planting activities on Undiri wetland, we do not plant trees like eucalyptus or just some exotic tree. We plant trees and grasses. Grasses here, I mean bamboo. Bamboo is actually a grass and not a tree. We plant indigenous trees like Olivea africana, like trees that are native to Kenya and specifically native to Kikuyu. I can't plant a tree that's native to let's say Samburu and bring it to Kikuyu. It will struggle. Like trees, if you think about trees, trees have feelings. Think of it like an animal. Like if you look at a tree, it's a living being. If you plant it somewhere, it connects with the soil. And if you plant it in a wrong place and it doesn't like the soil, it will die or it will become invasive. Invasive in the meaning that, for example, eucalyptus trees, so many of them, nothing can grow on the floor of the eucalyptus tree, meaning even grass cannot grow. When grass cannot grow, then other things like fungi or ferns cannot grow. When those things and mosses cannot grow, when those things don't grow, there's no biodiversity because those other fungi and ferns attract insects or other species that builds a whole ecosystem. So underneath a eucalyptus tree, there's no ecosystem. But underneath an indigenous tree, there's an ecosystem that grows. And an ecosystem is vital in enriching soils, in ensuring there's a cycle that happens within the soil. In the long run, it makes everything flow the way nature is supposed to flow. And then when I talk about tree planting, I like, for example, planting trees in Ondiri because it's a place I can walk and look at my tree and observe it. If it's broken, I can take care of it. If it's not been watered, I can take care of it. I don't participate in tree plantings that happen far away because I won't come back and look at this tree. For example, if I go to the Mau, I don't live in the Mau. How will I know my tree survived? How will I know someone is taking care of my tree? No one is. When you plant a tree, you have to be very, it should be like your baby. Like, for example, I'm the director of an organization called Tony Wild. And what we do is it works mostly in high schools. So in Form 1, the students plant a tree. And this tree, they have to take care of it until they're in Form 4. That's enough time to make sure even when they leave the school, the tree will still survive because they've taken care of it for 4 years. And I think why people don't like planting indigenous trees is because they take forever to grow. Even you, when you were a child, you did not become an adult immediately. You took 20 years. And that is how a tree is going to take. It's going to take 20 years. If a child who's born right now plants a tree, in 20 years' time, they can stand on its shade. So why do we like rushing things? Where are we heading to when we rush things? That's my perspective on tree growing and tree planting. It should be very strategic and we shouldn't rush it. While planting trees indigenous to our regions is valuable, it's still not a replacement to our existing forests. Do you get what I mean?
Yes, I get the statement.
We've become so obsessed with planting trees. We are forgetting our forests and we are going to cut forests. You know, it doesn't make sense. You're here busy planting trees, but then there's Mau Forest which you're cutting or Mount Kenya Forest which you're cutting. Who are you helping? You're solving one problem and killing another one.
That is so interesting. You know, my neighbor has children and they're all small and they're all very stubborn because they're small. And they have so many stories and they don't let her go. And I look at her and I tell her, you're very patient. You know, you're a very patient woman. And she laughs and she told me, what else do you want me to do? You know, there's nothing I can do. I can only be patient. So when you're talking about the trees and how you just need to be patient with it, I thought, this is a very good exercise, you know, in practicing patience. Like if you don't do anything else in this life, just plant a tree and nurture that tree. I think it just reminded me of my neighbor who's equally very patient. So I think, yeah, that's very interesting. So if you have a campaign, if you already are doing strategic tree planting through schools, how would you go about it for us adults who are out here? We are going to Mau to plant trees. How would you run a strategic tree planting campaign for us adults in order for us to do it sustainably and strategically?
For adults, this is how to take it. Look within your locality. If there's a nearby place where there's a tree planting, then do it. If you want to go plant trees in the Mau, do it. But how often are you going to go in the Mau? I always think of it like, in the first place, especially as adults, you know, as adults, we have the ability, we are voters. So you have the ability to tell your parliamentarian, no, to write letters to your parliamentarian and tell them, to your MP, and tell them, we don't agree with this. Or you write letters to your parliamentarian and your MP, and then you tell them, when they go to parliament, they say Mount Kenya Forest is being cut, and we don't want that to happen. And this is why it should not happen for the future of this country, especially a place like Mount Kenya, where it's a water storage place. Like this, it ensures that Nairobi has water. Just small acts like those, write to your MP, even if they don't listen, then go to your MCA, or go to even write to your governor, or just do something crazy. Like, don't be afraid to write to them. I always say we have the power as people. People don't realize this, but even if we elect leaders and they are rubbish type of leaders, we still have the power to tell them what to do. Even if you didn't vote for them, you have the power to tell them what to do. And that is their work. They are taking so much taxpayer money and going home. And then we forget, as people can be able to write letters to them and tell them when they go to parliament or when they go to senate, they do this and that. That's how I can say we can take action on tree planting. It's like, just go the big way and let your children plant trees wherever they want to plant. In when they grow up, they'll realize this is actually interesting. I want to plant more trees. Can we plant trees in our nearby school instead of going all the way to Mau Forest?
Very interesting. For example. Okay. But are you saying the ones that have been grown in Mau Forest don't thrive as much? So people who grew trees there, should they be hopeful? Did they die?
That's also another rant when it comes to the Mau Forest. So the Mau Forest, there are a lot of tree campaigns that have happened in the Mau Forest. But this is how I look at things in the Mau Forest. In the first place, the indigenous people who are living there were chased. But why were they chased? Why were they not taught you can plant this tree along with your maize, along with your beans, along with your whatever you're planting? If you go plant trees, like I've been to the Mau, and there are some areas where you see trees have been planted and they're not thriving anymore because no one is taking care of them. When you went to plant trees in the Mau, did you ensure there were local people there, or it was just you coming from somewhere, whether it was Nakuru or Nairobi, and then going all the way there? Did you look around and see the local people? Did you talk to them? Did you tell them you will be taking care of this tree? Are you willing to take care of this tree? That's what I mean by trees in the Mau or trees somewhere far away. Like, I've been to places like Mount Kenya recently, not recently, like you go there and then you hear there are people who came to plant trees, yet there are no trees because there's no one to take care of them. A place like Mount Kenya, an elephant will come and eat the shoots. So it needs to be like guarded or planted in a place where it can be fenced off for a while until the trees mature, because elephants are very destructive, until the trees mature and then left open once the trees mature. So like for tree planting, for example, it would be quite strategic. Like, even if it's done in a national park, you can decide we're going to fence off this area for like 5 years until the biodiversity comes back. Like, there should be, it shouldn't be just, we're going to plant trees, yay! And then when you come back 2 years from now, will you see that tree? Or where will the tree be? That's what I mean.
Yeah, and you know, someone might think, fence it off for 10 years and think that's a long time, but it's really not. Because as you grow up, you see yourself, you were once 10 years old, and then you were 20, and then you were 30. Time flies. So it's not a long time at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a suggestion for you, since you have a blog. I think a lot of people who listen to this would be wondering, okay, I can write a letter to the governor, but they probably don't even know what to say. Could you please write us a template on your blog on what to say, how to address them? And then, or just, you know, when you're starting your podcast, just let us know, how do we go about it? Because I can tell you for a fact, for free, that after people vote after every 5 years, most people don't even interact with their MPs at all. A lot of us don't even know. We can write a letter, or we can even call them or use whatever channels to express ourselves. So this is new. So if you could just tell us how to do that, that would be amazing. It would break down a barrier, I think.
That's something I can do. Like, there's an organization I used to work for. We actually used to write templates for maybe major issues. So I can actually work on just writing a letter. But it's as simple as just stating your facts, just writing who you are, who you're writing as, why you're writing, just simple way. Even if it doesn't get read, you know, you'll sit at the back of your mind and think, I wrote a letter. The problem is people want action now. But if you think about it, the environment should be number one issue, by the way. It should be the number one topic of discussion. Because if you talk about the environment, we would not be having droughts. That will be something for the forgotten of the past. We would not be having water shortages. We would not be having flooding. What else is facing this country? We would not even be having health issues if we protect the environment. But we don't think of it that way, as you want to solve droughts. But to solve droughts, it has to be in the environmental way. Okay. To solve just simple things. So yes, I can work on writing a draft letter. But the thing is, with writing a letter, I can be writing a letter. Maybe there was sometimes they do call outs in the newspaper for public participation on a specific issue that is environmental. You can reference, let's say, something like that. But I can actually work on doing a letter on that, or bring someone who's actually or have a guest writer, or when I start my podcast, have a guest come who's actually very involved in policy making, because that's entirely policy making.
That would be perfect.
Environmental policy. Yeah.
Yes. Who can break it down very simply. And especially during this election year, I think more people need to know about it.
Yes, they do.
Okay. Second last question from me. So at the very local level, household level, right? How do we continue pursuing wealth? You know, material wealth, because that's what most people are focused on, while still adopting sustainable practices. Can we do both? Do we have the headspace for both? You know, do we have the capacity to put things into that perspective? Because that's one perspective.
Yes, it's actually very simple. The people don't realize it. I'll give an example. For example, people in, what is it called? I don't like calling it what I want to call it. Like people in Kibra, you will find that they keep containers, or they collect containers, like plastic containers. They like keep them, they reuse them, or if they don't reuse them, they sell them, or they keep a bunch of them, which they sell. And they still live their life. Do you know that is sustainable practices that we do not realize they actually do? If you think about someone in the rural area, they will keep the bread packets and the unga packets, and they will use them later. That's a sustainable practice that they do. The problem with the quote unquote middle class, there is the issue of we like to think we can have this thing and throw it away. But this throwaway mentality, it's so bad, because where are you throwing it away? It will still come back. So for me, for example, in the terms of quote unquote middle class and building wealth and all those things, you can do simple things like stop using plastic in your house. You have no idea how huge that will have an impact. Or stop using chemical-filled detergents. There are so many detergents out here that are just killing our ecosystem. Like developing, for example, when you wash clothes and the soap you use, you have no idea that there's microplastic in that soap. That microplastics ends up in the water system It goes all the way to the ocean, to our rivers, to our system all over for water, to even our underground water. Just simple, doing simple things like that. Living a sustainable lifestyle for me means looking, sitting down and looking at what do you throw away on a daily basis. Do you throw away food, which can become organic fertilizer? Do you throw away plastic, which you didn't actually need in the first place? Do you throw away clothes which you can give out or mend? Maybe it was just a small torn, a small tear, and then you saw, I can throw this. But you could mend it. Why are you throwing it? That's why we have tailors, to mend these things, or you can tailor it yourself. So just simple practices. Look, just sit down and look at what you produce. It could even be simple as you might be having 5 cars in one household. It's a lot. That's a lot of carbon footprint that house has. They are producing so much. If everyone is going with their own vehicle and they're going to the same direction, where can they go with one car? Just simple acts. Or where can they walk? Let's say you are walking from, let's say, Ondiri to Kikuyu, and then you take a bike. For what purpose? It's very near. You can decide to walk. Just those simple steps that make a difference, just small things. Just look at how you're living your life, what you're doing, and what you can change. And then it will make a huge difference.
All right. And I don't think this means that, you know, people should stop having fun or not consume what they are interested in. I think it's just, what are we willing to do away with, and then do away with that at least.
Yeah.
And then keep having fun as much as you want.
Yes. And you can also, I always say, for example, the food you eat. People also, the food we eat is also an environmental aspect. If tomatoes, for example, or wherever you buy food, why do you have to buy food in a supermarket and you can go in a market where you are supporting a whole livelihood? That's how I think about it. If you buy in a supermarket, who are you supporting? The supermarket. You're not growing anything. If you buy in a market, you're supporting a whole family and you don't know. Just small acts. Just small acts. Just look at what you're doing and what you can change. It's not bad to have fun. In fact, have all the fun you can have, because if you restrict yourself, then you'll begin hating the environment, because you'll be like, I'm working so hard to protect the environment. I can't even have fun. And then in the end, you hate on the environment. For what purpose?
So in terms of supermarkets, supermarkets also support a lot of livelihoods as well. And perhaps even purchase those tomatoes from smallholder farmers as well. But I still get your point at the same time. Yeah.
Okay. I always say, like, if for me, for example, I was recently told that, for example, Carrefour gets some tomatoes from farmers around Ondiri. Then I would buy tomatoes from there. Like, you have to do your research. Where is the supermarket getting their food? Are they getting their tomatoes from South Africa? Why am I buying tomatoes from South Africa and their tomato farmers in Kenya? Like, just doing your research.
Okay. So a lot of education is what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
Just take the time to educate yourself slowly and surely, and then make the changes required. And then going back to you using Nairobi as an example, which used to be a swamp. So we basically built houses and offices on a sponge.
Yeah.
And we've done so much more. What do we do now? I mean, what do we do?
What we do now?
Know that we've done Nairobi, what we've done.
Yeah. Nairobi, for example, has so many green spaces around it. That is what we need to protect. The green spaces, the rivers, the river that flows across Nairobi, the dams that we have in Nairobi, the green spaces, for example, Uhuru Park, Nairobi National Park. Uhuru Park is also another ranting story. Nairobi National Park, City Park, all the rivers that flow across Nairobi, just making sure they are clean. Like recently, there have been so many demolitions on buildings that were on wetlands. For example, there was the Nakumat UK, which was in Parklands. That building was demolished. And then there was, because it was on a wetland, and then there was the building that was along Mombasa Road. Was it Mombasa Road? Not Mombasa Road. I think it was called T-Mall, if I'm not wrong. That was also demolished because it was on a wetland. So when we have leaders who come and do such things, then we can move forward. We don't want to stop development, because it's important, but we can also have development which is sustainable. And in the end, there are so many people that people actually don't know, but there are so many campaigns going on right now to protect green spaces. in Nairobi. And it's not even the green spaces like the ones I've mentioned. There are so many green spaces in even Githurai, in even Kibera, that currently young people are working to reduce, to stop pollution, for example, or like collect litter, like plastic litter, and use it for valuable uses. There's so many things going on, and I think that is what needs to be highlighted. Then there can be more hope, and then people can realize people are taking action on the ground. And I can also do my little thing. So I don't think it's a dead end. For me, I don't think it's a dead end, because like I said earlier, I have gone through the grieving process and realized what is working and what is not working.
Awesome. How do we know about these campaigns and green spaces? At the very least, is there a resource?
Currently, there's no resource. But there will be one in, I'd say, between now and before the elections. There's a campaign going on called Cities for Forests, which is working towards enlightening people about green spaces in Nairobi and what you can do to protect them. And there's also a group called Daima Coalition Group, or you can check, I think it's Daima. It's called Daima Coalition Group. You can check it on social media. It's working with so many environmentalists, Daima Green Spaces on social media. It's working with so many environmental conservation organizations to bring green spaces into the limelight.
Awesome. I think that's a great way to end this conversation. Honestly, has brought up more questions in me than I started. And I think you're very knowledgeable. You have a lot in you that I feel needs to be shared. So we are looking forward to your blog and to your podcast, because you know, when you talk, it's a bit more nuanced and someone can ask for clarity, etc. So we are looking forward to your podcast. To be honest, I'm looking forward to it. And let us know when it drops. I will leave a link to your blog on Anchor, Spotify, YouTube, everywhere that people listen to us from. Do you have anything you'd like to say as a final word to our audience?
As a final word, I'd say be mindful of what you're doing every single day, because I believe if you're mindful, when you're kind to human beings, then you become kind to planet Earth. Like, it just works like that, because I always say this every single time. We are a part of nature. We belong to nature. It's not nature belonging to us. Nature does not owe us anything. We owe nature so much. If the human race was to disappear right now, nature would be so excited, but it will be so sad, because we are not a part of it. Because we are generally just a part of nature. No matter what we do, no matter what we say, no matter how we live our life, and we owe nature so much in everything that we do, because it gives us the air that we breathe and clean water. Those are the basic things, like breathing. It's very important, and we get it from nature. Even if, for example, in the dinosaur age, if you believe in that type of stuff, they used to breathe in carbon dioxide. It was part of nature. So now we're breathing oxygen. It is part of nature. We are not apart away from it. We are very, very much a part of nature, and we should take care of it so that it takes care of us. If we don't take care of it, it will just look at us and evolve and bring about diseases or bring about calamities to destroy us. So we need to just take care of nature, and it will take care of us.
Wonderful. Nothing to add from me. So, audience, until next time.